This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a great day, a day with all kinds of reasons for celebration. Not only because we have a new year coming up and our great decision is going to be made this year about the direction of the country. That's what elections are for. And but also because our long national nightmare of impeachment is going to be dealt with almost surely before the Iowa caucuses, which are coming right up 1 month from today. That's right. They're coming up on February 3rd of 2020. So everything is seen in a political context, including the impeachment, including the wonderful news. And it is wonderful news that one of the world's most evil terrorists, someone certainly who ranks up there with al-Baghdadi and with bin Laden, Soleimani, who for many, many years has supervised the Iranian efforts to destabilize the whole world on behalf of Shia Islam, Soleimani's death is also a matter of some concern. Somebody who can speak about all of these issues and what it means for the ongoing impeachment melodrama is Noah Rothman, who is the online editor for Commentary Magazine, which is a journal for which I am privileged to write from time to time. Last couple of issues I have been. And Noah is also somebody with some knowledge of what is going on politically and internationally. Now, first of all, let's follow the pattern that was demonstrated by Senator Schumer and by Senator McConnell this morning. They spoke first about Soleimani and then went on to impeachment, and they didn't agree about anything. So is Senator McConnell right that the death of Soleimani will be remembered as a high point for the Trump administration?
Well, it's certainly too early to say, but standing from today's vantage point, it's a high point. This was a very long time coming. Even if you don't care about his efforts to destabilize the region in Lebanon and Syria and Yemen and Iraq, even if you don't care about the thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands who might still be alive were it not for his efforts in Syria to orchestrate starvation campaigns and crimes against humanity, even if you don't care about any of that, Pentagon estimates that roughly 1 in 6 American casualties in Iraq over the last decade were attributable to Iranian actions. That was Soleimani's work. He was the guy behind the border creating training camps and setting up factories for shaped charges that would eventually make their way into IEDs. And the Iranians were executing a campaign of reckless antagonism targeting the United States for almost a year. Starting in the spring of last year, they were hijacking ships in the Strait of Hormuz, sabotaging internationally flagged ships, including NATO vessels, NATO flagged vessels, attacking the world's largest petroleum facility in Saudi Arabia brazenly, openly, downing an American drone, for which they faced no consequences. And in December, over the course of December, sophisticated rocket attacks were raining down on American positions. And December 27th, it killed an American contractor and wounded 3 other Americans, and the Trump administration responded proportionately, targeting those militias only. And the response by Iran was to ratchet up tensions further, laying siege to our embassy and directly threatening the U.S. diplomatic position in Baghdad. The United States was compelled to respond to these escalating tensions. They finally did. And this is not itself a destabilizing effort. It is an effort to de-escalate the situation by limiting Iran's capacity to execute these kind of strikes, by compelling it to face the fact that there are consequences for its actions that may be disproportionate to what it perceives to be the benefit associated with those actions. That is the essence of deterrence. When deterrence breaks down, it has to be forcefully restored. It doesn't restore itself. And so the effort here by the Trump administration to fully deter an undeterred Iran is a step toward de-escalating the situation in the Middle East, contrary to a lot of this administration's critics.
There's one other aspect of this, and I'd love to get your response. I'm speaking to Noah Rothman of Commentary Magazine, is that for years and years and years, people have been suggesting that we were helpless in dealing with Iran. That was the basic line in behalf of the Iran nuclear accord, which President Trump drew us out of, I think rightly. The idea that we couldn't do anything about their nuclear capacity short of some kind of all-out war where we actually went over and destroyed it. Doesn't this illustrate that there are a range of responses available to the United States short of all-out war with Iran?
Of course there are. And we had hamstrung ourselves. Mostly we were self-deterred by our own concern about the kind of asymmetric warfare that Iran can and may yet execute in places like Southeast Asia and Europe. And that could still be forthcoming. But what we've developed over the course of the last decade is a spectacular new technology, fracking and hydraulic drilling, that has allowed us to be functionally energy independent and to calm the oil markets in the event of a shock. It's one of the reasons why this campaign of Iranian agitation in the Strait of Hormuz did not yield a multinational military effort to restore transactions of commerce on that strait, because the United States could backstop the world's oil market. Did Trump, the Bush administration, during the campaign in Iraq, when it was confronted with this Iran-fueled insurgency, was unable to take these steps for fear of how the oil markets would react and how their allies would react. The Iranian campaign is all about an effort to ease pressure on it by making America's European allies squeamish. And to the extent the United States and its capacity to export energy can ease tensions in Europe and make them a little more steadfast, it is wholly beneficial to not only the United States and its interests abroad, but those of its allies and global peace and security. This is all good. And it's strange to see Democrats react to it as hostilely as they have.
Well, doesn't it sort of indicate, we were speaking yesterday with David French about how today, the same way that people once upon a time would see absolutely everything through a religious lens, if you were a member of a given religious faith, then you saw everything in line with that religion. Today, politics has become the replacement. In other words, the thing that if it's a good news for your enemy and you define your number one enemy as Donald J. Trump, then it can't be good news for you, rather than actually viewing this as something that should be seen as good news for the world. And when I say this, I mean the death of Soleimani. Let me ask you this. In terms of the ongoing impeachment, which you've just recently written about in commentary, we are at a standoff because your non-namesake, Noah Feldman, do you get confused with him a lot?
Often.
Okay.
Mostly on Twitter. I've been often accused of having Noah Feldman's position.
Okay,
Twitter,
but you're
to respond.
Well, good, because you're very different. You're certainly very different on this issue of impeachment. Noah Feldman, the other guy, the professor at Harvard Law School, was one of the people who testified before the House Judiciary Committee on behalf of impeachment. You, however, Noah Rothman of commentary, have been extremely persuasive on how it is that Nancy Pelosi is just blowing it almost beyond recognition in terms of her handling of impeachment. Why?
Yeah, totally blowing. First of all, I should say at the outset that I think the allegations against the president are extremely credible and extremely serious. The weaponization of American foreign policy to affect domestic political priorities is, in my view, an impeachable offense, arguable as to whether or not it merits removal from office, which is a very grave and serious situation that should weigh heavily on lawmakers. But I think it's a very serious offense. Nevertheless, the Democratic argument was that this process had to be rushed, basically.
It was urgent. It was urgent. We couldn't have a single day more with President Trump as president. We are in danger.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah. And now they're effectively arguing the opposite, that the Senate has to slow this whole thing down because there's new revelations coming out through Freedom of Information Act requests filed by media organizations. They're saying, oh, we have to hear from people like John Bolton and Don McGahn, and we can't wait.
Michael Duffy.
The Senate has to subpoena these people. But they had gotten favorable rulings on the McGahn situation, for example. They just had to wait for it to work its way through the appeals court, but they couldn't wait. But now they're contradicting their own argument And now Nancy Pelosi is holding on to these articles under the presumption that she can affect some sort of pressure on the Senate, but no pressure exists. She's in a standoff with herself. She's taken herself hostage and won't negotiate. And I don't know how anybody's supposed to respond to that, but with pity. They're undermining their own arguments that they made over the course of these weeks of the inquiry phase. They no longer control this process. They sacrificed that control to the Republican-led Senate. And now they're attempting to impose some kind of conditions on the Senate, but no one's listening. So it just makes them look impotent and undermines their own case.
Without question, I think you have a very good line in your piece and commentary at Commentary Online, where you say Nancy Pelosi has taken herself hostage and she's threatening to shoot herself in the head. And to which Mitch McConnell says, go ahead, make my day.
Right. Well, what pressure is there there? They have no influence. And it just demonstrates how little strategy there is to this affair, which, by the way, was Nancy Pelosi's instincts. And in the piece that I had yesterday, kind of going after this notion that Nancy Pelosi had this great year in 2019. She had a terrible year. She lost control of the plot really early. The effort on the part of the Democrats when they came into the majority again was to focus on anti-corruption measures. They wanted H.R. 1, was this anti-corruption bill and voting rights bill, to be the centerpiece of their legislation. It was immediately subsumed into the progressive effort to shift the conversation towards the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, both of which Nancy Pelosi despised. She went to war with her progressive counterparts, the triumvirate that called the Squad. It failed, lost that effort to sideline these members. And then finally, after pushing for months since the Mueller report came out to avoid an impeachment process, her hand was forced, arguably by the administration. I think that's fair, but nevertheless, all the things that she feared would come to pass have come to pass. It has not reflected well on Democrats. It has not been a political benefit. It has undermined their strategy, undermined their communication strategy and their objectives. And Nancy Pelosi, just based on her own behavior, is demonstrating every day that they don't know how this ends. They've gotten themselves, they painted themselves into a corner and can't get out.
Okay. Let me try something out on you, because my basic take on this, and the reason that Nancy Pelosi ended up again contradicting her own instincts and overcoming her own instincts and going along with impeachment, which she had spent months and months and months talking down, is because basically they want this entire election to be about Trump's personality. They don't want it to be about issues. Why don't they want it to be about issues? Because the Democratic Party is nuts on issues. They're all talking about reparations for slavery. They're talking about outlawing private health insurance. They're talking about retreat from the world. They're talking about forgiving all college debt and free college for all and spending as far as the eye can see. And they've all gotten so far to the left that Nancy Pelosi and others say, OK, we better keep this all about Trump, because if we keep it all about Trump, and is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? Is he a great president or is he a terrible president? If we make it about Trump personally, then we have a chance of winning. Do you think that might be part of the calculation here, why they want to draw out this impeachment process?
Yeah, I mean, that's as good an explanation as any.
I'll
sign on to it. I'll sign on to it, sure, because I can't for the life of me figure out what the long game is here. I mean, like you say, you know, one of the I'm losing my train of thought, but one of the things that I lost my train of thought.
Well, here's part of what I think I can help with. You're a young guy. And you have no memories of Watergate. People like Chuck Schumer, who I've known for a very, very long time. Chuck Schumer was a Watergate baby. He was basically formed by the Watergate experience. And when they started off going after Richard Nixon, nobody thought it would lead to his resignation. And they just kept finding more and more and more stuff, including that smoking gun tape. I honestly believe that people like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, who was also formed out of that Watergate experience, they believe that their experience with Trump is going to lead to something like that, that there's some kind of deep, dark secret, and it's just a matter of ferreting it out. That's why they care so much about witnesses. I don't know what they expect John Bolton is going to tell them that's going to go beyond what we already know. But I suspect it's almost a visceral sense that they believe that there will be something else that will be unspeakably incriminating against President Trump.
Well, maybe their actions betray that they probably don't. Otherwise, we would have had a longer inquiry phase and they would have allowed the courts to adjudicate their subpoenas. But they didn't. I mean, they just moved on. They closed the venue. So the court said, look, these issues are mooted. You don't have a venue in which these people are subpoenaed anymore. So maybe, maybe not. I'm of the mind that the Office of Budget and Management didn't just do this on a whim. There's a paper trail somewhere. We know these orders came from the president. And there's a paper trail somewhere to suggest that what the president hoped to achieve by cutting off this aid and threatening going up against the legal timeline in which it had to be dispersed. So that probably exists somewhere. But the notion that we would see it at this point seems unlikely.
And even if we do, they're not going to get 67 senators to vote to remove President Trump from office. What about we are one month away from the Iowa caucuses? Who is the one Democrat that President Trump should fear most?
General election is a wild ride and you never know what's going to happen. They're all viable in their own way, which should make Republicans very scared. Probably the conventional wisdom is right that Joe Biden represents the biggest threat because he is the most appealing to the most voters, according to polls, general election polls. I suspect that the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren types have gone so far to the left that they're no longer viable candidates in a general election. But Joe Biden has defied the left, has run the campaign that he can run by being a sort of relatable, not too eccentric and not too too emphatically progressive candidate, and that has rendered him a viable candidate.
Okay, let me ask you this: what about the possibility? And there is serious talk about this now, that if they go to the convention and Biden wins the convention, that Bernie or a Bernie stand-in decides I have to run as a third-party candidate, which of course automatically reelects Trump. Don't you think that this angry left, that's a real possibility?
Yeah, maybe. I'm skeptical of that sort of situation because especially the opposition to Donald Trump is going to coalesce around the most viable opposition candidate. You're going to have any third party candidate is going to peel off a few percentage points, but enough to.
That's
to really
all it took last time. That's all it took last time. And because, as you know, 6% of voters voted for third and fourth and fifth party candidates in the last election. If that happens again, it seems to me almost a sure thing that President Trump would win because President Trump supporters are extremely enthusiastic.
Yeah, it would. It most certainly would. I mean, Donald Trump has the advantage of being an incumbent and an incumbent with a record that's relatively admirable, at least on economics and foreign policy. If they make it about his personality, then it's going to be a much harder election for him. It absolutely will. And Joe Biden is best positioned to do that because he's basically all the good stuff without the tweet.
But also, I am sure that President Trump and his $100 million war chest, which he has accumulated so far. We're also going to hear lots and lots about Hunter Biden, which is probably not going to make Joe very happy. Speaking with Noah Rothman, Noah is the online editor for Commentary Magazine. He's also a frequent guest on cable news all over the place. You can follow Noah on Twitter, at Noah C. Rothman. And you can read his columns at commentarymagazine.com. Coming right up, there is a devastating piece. I mean, it's a very long piece, very detailed piece with quotations in it that are fairly unbelievable about the rise in anti-Semitism and particularly the intense rise in anti-Semitism in the African-American community. Why? And what do you do about it? We'll be talking about that with the author of that article and more coming up on The Medved Show. I was sent a really remarkable piece about double standards and anti-Semitism. And with a piece that appeared in Front Page magazine. And it turned out that the author was also the author of a rather extraordinary book that I have read most of. The book is called God Through Binoculars, A Hitchhiker at a Monastery. And it's written by Danusha Goska, who is a very serious Catholic and an Eastern European Catholic, and particularly with so much emphasis in terms of anti-Semitism, the rise of anti-Semitism focused right now on Eastern Europe. It's fascinating to see her piece. And Danusha, it's great to speak to you directly on the air. Thank you for the piece, which linked to our website at michaelmedved.com. The full headline is Attacks on Jews in New York and Media Double Standards. We need to talk about black anti-Semitism. You have a conclusion to your piece, which I just think is so eloquent and so beautifully written. You say, separate systems of ethics for blacks and whites are no more moral than separate water fountains for blacks and whites. Human decency should not be emblazoned with a whites-only sign. It's not imperialist or racist for people who aren't African-American to speak out against black anti-Semitism. Why did you personally, Danusha, given the fact that you're not, in fact, Jewish, why did you feel the need to speak out so forcefully here?
Michael, I've been working on Christian-Jewish and Polish-Jewish relations for 30 years. And I think there's two inspirations for that. One is a sort of spiritual epigenetics. My mother, when she was a child, went swimming in the river Nitra near her village Kovarce in Slovakia. And she did not know how to swim, and she began to drown. And one of the neighbor children saved her life. And that child was a Jew, and he was later murdered by the Nazis. And I have a personal debt to him, because if it were not for him, I wouldn't be here, because my mother would have drowned. And there's a more immediate cause. During a trip to Poland, I met Arno Lowy, whose father was in the Płaszów concentration camp depicted in Schindler's List. And Arno and I connected at a very deep level, and he sparked my becoming involved in Polish-Jewish relations, and I've never looked back.
Okay. In terms of the current episodes of anti-Semitism, and there are more, and again, I can tell you, living my life in the Jewish community, there is genuine trepidation, especially after this horrible attack in Hanukkah and Muncie. What do the media get wrong in their reporting of these attacks?
I think that people mean well. People do not want to engage in anti-black racism. And our country has a history of depicting black people in a very negative and stereotyped way. And people are afraid of falling into that trap. But at the same time, the videos that we're seeing of black people spitting on Jews, punching Jews, using obscene language to address Jews, we have to express outrage against this, and we have to talk about the perpetrators, and we have to do this for the sake of clarity, and we also have to do this for the sake of releasing tension, because if you read the comments section near news reports, you'll see that average people are noticing that we're not talking about the demographics at hand. You know, I live in New Jersey. I live 13 miles away from Jersey City, and I was terrified when I heard the news accounts of this assault on a kosher supermarket, and I wanted to know who was doing the attacking, and it wasn't until, I think, a day later that we got any information. So withholding information from the public is making the situation worse rather than better.
Have you seen, and I'm sure you have, Danusha Goska, the videos that actually were not widely shown on cable TV or anywhere else, the videos of reaction after the police came, after the shootings had taken place, after all the participants were dead, the ones who died, the four innocent victims and the two killers. The street reaction there in Jersey City out in front of the kosher market?
No, I did not see that.
It was horrifying. And because there were people in the neighborhood who were saying they deserved to die and blank the Jews. And this literally while the bodies were still warm.
Well, this has a reflection in the school board. Joan Terrell Page, who's a member of the school board in Jersey City, posted a Facebook message implying that the killers were martyrs attempting to protect black people from the dangerous Jews. And she is still on the school board. And yesterday, Thursday, people spoke up in defense of her at a school board meeting. And I think that when people are saying something that's wrong, it's factually incorrect and it's morally wrong, if you respect those people as your fellow adult, you tell them that they're doing something wrong.
Absolutely right. I think that the most powerful lines in your piece, which I heartily recommend everybody, I mean, you quote extensively from a long speech and an incredibly anti-Semitic speech given by one of the leaders of the so-called Nation of Islam, which, by the way, most American Muslims do not recognize as genuinely Islamic. But that's Louis Farrakhan's operation. And you look at Louis Farrakhan himself. He has gotten a pass for, what,
yes,
40 years, hasn't he?
Yes, yes, yes. And you can see photographs online of Louis Farrakhan sitting comfortably with Bill Clinton and Jesse Jackson. These are powerful people.
You write in your piece, the black, and you quote Khalid Abdul-Muhammad, whose speech you quote at length. In his speech, he says, the black Holocaust is 100 times worse than the so-called Jew Holocaust. And that's what he said on the campus of Howard University. And he you go on to say, this articulated hatred must be described, denounced, and deconstructed. There should be forthright academic articles, conferences, and curricula now condemning this murderous anti-Semitism. Those who take this task face daunting odds. Those odds make this work no less vital and urgent. What do you see for the immediate future?
Unfortunately, I see more of the same. You know, before our phone call, I was looking at an article from the New York Times from 1969, and that article could have been written today. And the 1969
article... It was during the teacher strike, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And there were reports of synagogues being firebombed and very anti-Semitic statements being made. And there were some people saying, maybe we shouldn't address this, because if we address this, we'll just cause more problems. And I don't think it works that way. And in a subsequent article for Front Page, which has not yet appeared, I mentioned that polls have been internationally shamed. And I'm not crazy about that, but at the same time, that shame has caused many polls to engage in self-examination and mea culpas, and to work very hard at addressing the anti-Semitism that does exist in Polish culture.
So Danusia Goska, I so much appreciate your work and your work particularly in that regard. Her new book is called God Through Binoculars, and it's fascinating, as she is. I wish you a wonderful weekend and a great year. When we come back, more on why is America so depressed? Coming up. On the Michael Medved Show, as everybody is looking forward to, I hope, a great January weekend, first weekend of the new year. Just to get into the spirit of things, the New York Times runs a great big column under the heading, Why is America So Depressed? And... Yeah, I was hoping when I saw that headline, before I realized it was by Lee Siegel, who is a very brilliant writer and enormously depressing to read. I was hoping that a column that said, why is America so depressed, would have as part of it, hey, guys, come out of it and shake them a little bit. We have no reason to be depressed. I know the market's down today and people are terribly worried about what really should be good news, which is the death of Soleimani in Iraq, where he was killed. Okay, the truth of the matter is we're so fortunate to be here, to live the lives we do. And here's what Lee Siegel has to say and his remedy for depression. His remedy for depression is electing someone like Jimmy Carter. No, I'm serious. That's what he writes. Listen to this. He says, everyone has his or her own definition of a political crisis. Mine is when our collective mental health starts having a profound effect on our politics and vice versa. It cannot be a simple coincidence that the two have declined in tandem. And he says, all of this mental carnage is occurring at a time when decades of social and political division have set us against each other. Black and white, men and women, old and young. Beyond bitter social antagonisms, the country is racked by mass shootings, and the murder rate in general has gone down everywhere except Baltimore. And when I say everywhere except Baltimore, really pretty, it's in Chicago the mass shootings have gone down 3 years in a row. In any event, he goes on. Beyond bitter social antagonism, the country is racked by mass shootings, the mind-bending perils of the internet, revelations of widespread sexual predation, the worsening effects of climate change, virulent competition. Why is virulent competition a negative thing? It's kind of the essence of how you make progress, isn't it? In any event. And then he goes, the specter of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, grinding student debt, and crises in housing, in healthcare, and higher education. Okay, is there anything there, really? He doesn't mention terrorism. And when he says things like the decades of social and political division have set us against each other, black and white, do we really have a worse racial situation than we did, say, 50 years ago? Are you kidding me? I mean, how nonsensical that is. And men and women, right? Men and women are getting along worse today. Well, actually, there is some reporting that it's a tough time to be a man. We'll be talking to a professor later on who's done some research on that. He says, the frightening environment helps cause depression. Depression causes catastrophic thinking, and catastrophic thinking makes the environment seem even more terrifying than it is. In other words, there's a vicious cycle, and a cycle of what? Of self-pity is what it is. And it's groundless. He says this, does Lee Siegel. I would not have sat down to write this if I had not been tormented over the past few years by my own challenges, including frequent thoughts of suicide. But with that exception of one morning a year and a half ago, when the effects of the withdrawal from the Valium that I had been taking nightly for 18 months were so overpowering that I nearly stepped in front of a subway train, my fantasies of killing myself have been just that. Dreams of escape that would obliterate my pain without ending my life. Along with visits to a therapist, since my experience with Valium, I have refused for now to take psychiatric medication. Good. I have my own coping strategies. Picking out Over the Rainbow on the piano, my wife and I have rented for our 9-year-old daughter, I realize that the first two notes, somewhere, are identical, separated by an octave. The seven notes between them correspond to the seven colors of a rainbow. Thus, the song musically embodies the leap from unfulfilling Kansas to the enchanted world of Oz. Actually, is that the message of that movie? Unfulfilling Kansas? There's no place like home, Dorothy says. And she's actually really glad when she gets home. And yes, I know Kansas is in black and white, Oz is in color, et cetera, et cetera. The process of struggling to conceive of a positive idea of the future that would enable me to leap out of my depression, I have begun to call to myself octave thinking. Okay, the idea that it is so impossible to leap out of our depression, there's a terrific piece by, I honestly think, one of the truly great thinkers of our time, whose name is Jonathan Sacks. He is a former chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth, and he writes a very persuasive piece about why it would be that right now we would be feeling so fearful and anti-Semitism would be coming at us with such force. And part of what he talks about is, quote, everything associated with the internet. He says, because of everything associated with the internet, smartphones, viral videos, and above all social media, these have what is called a disinhibition effect. People are far more hateful when communicating electronically than when speaking face-to-face. Cyberspace has proven to be the most effective incubator of resentment, rancor, and conspiracy theories ever invented. Anti-Semitism thrives on conspiracy theories. Versions of the blood libel and the protocols of the Elders of Zion, updated for the 21st century. And then he goes and says, secondly, because of the way people encounter these phenomena, often alone in the privacy of their own home, this allows them to be radicalized without anyone realizing it is happening. Time and again, we read of people carrying out horrific attacks while those who knew them recall not having seen any warning signs that they were intent on committing evil attacks. The point about all of this is that you see the two things that we've talked about a lot on this show. The epidemic of loneliness and the attempt people have to use the web, the internet, to try to address and to salve their loneliness. And what's the answer? The answer is actually family, community, and yes, often engagement in religious life. That's certainly something that Rabbi Sacks advocates for. His piece, we'll post on our website. It's called The Keys to Understanding American Anti-Semitism and Fighting Back. But it's also the keys to fighting back against American depression that Lee Siegel writes about. And the biggest key of all is something else we talk about, which is gratitude, to be thankful for what we have. I mean, for all those problems, those horrors that are cataloged by Lee Siegel, they're all manageable if we remember how fortunate we are to live the lives we do, to have the choices we enjoy as citizens, residents of this greatest nation on God's green earth.